going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
To the CJP Me Debrief Podcast, where we discuss breaking events and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Together, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. 2 months ago, Fernwood Publishing announced a new book, Advocating for Palestine in Canada, one of the first ever books about Palestinian solidarity work in Canada. One of the chapters was written by me, Tom Woodley, discussing the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats that lie before the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in Canada. With Michael on vacation, our podcast engineer, Madeline Moffat, will join me on microphone to discuss my chapter to explore the potential opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for the movement. My name is Tom Woodley. I'm the president of CJPME and the podcast host for today. As I mentioned, with me is Madeline Moffat, CJPME's operations manager and the person behind the scenes at Debrief, helping to make everything run smoothly. So welcome, Madeline. Thanks for stepping up to the microphone today.
Thank you so much, Tom. I'm really excited to finally be on the podcast.
Yeah, it's great. Well, actually, Madeline and I were, it was a discussion that we had back in, I think, August that actually got CJPME Debrief. So was the genesis of CJPME Debrief. So thanks again, Madeline.
No problem.
So rather than me asking the questions on this podcast, you're the one who's going to be doing the interrogating. How do you want to start this?
Well, first off, why don't you start by telling me a bit about how this book came together? How long was it in the works and how did you end up contributing a chapter?
Yeah, well, that's a good way to start. The book actually stems from a conference that was hosted at the University of Ottawa in February 2019, our friend and colleague Jeremy Wildeman, who's a postdoc at the University of Ottawa, wanted to bring together a lot of different people doing academic research on Palestine and Palestinian solidarity work. And so we brought a lot of people together in Ottawa there in February 2019. And there was also a an NGO session where Jeremy brought together some of the people representing a few of the NGOs working on the Palestine issue. And then coming out of that conference, Jeremy recommended that maybe we should put together a book with contributors, each contributing a chapter, based on some of the presenting that had been done at that conference. Now, at the conference itself, Jeremy wanted me to present, and I said, I think he wanted me to sort of write something or something like that. And I said, look, Jeremy, I'm just so busy. But what I could do is I could do this SWOT analysis of the Palestine Solidarity Movement. Would this be of interest? Like, I can't sort of sit down and write an entirely new chapter on something new, but I can sort of just sort of talk from my own experiences in terms of strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities and threats for the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And so that's sort of how it came. That's how my session at the symposium came together. And then Jeremy and the other editors of the book invited me to then contribute a chapter to the book based on my presentation at the symposium.
Cool. So you said SWOT, and that stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Why did you want to write your chapter about SWOT, specifically in the Palestinian solidarity movement as a whole?
Sure. Yeah, well, S for strengths, W for weaknesses, opportunities for O for opportunities, and T for threats, so SWOT. You know, it's a business tool. Many people probably do know that I only got involved in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in my mid-30s. My wife and I sort of did it together. My wife is Palestinian-Canadian. And but we'd had a lot of experience in the business world, in the corporate world. And a SWOT exercise is something that's often done as a business tool. You know, there's a lot of different ways to sort of do strategic planning and strategic analysis in the business arena. But the SWOT SWOT exercise is a very quick thing that you can do and sometimes very quickly identify sort of things that you need to be doing or things that you should stop doing or things that you need to be aware of and things that you need to prepare for. So the SW, the strengths and weaknesses, generally tend to speak to sort of the internal factors of what you're analyzing. So if you're a business or a company, you sort of want, well, what are our strengths and weaknesses? And these are largely things that are in your control or have been in your control to some degree in the past. And then the OT, the opportunities and threats, are largely external factors, things that you don't have too much control over, but things that which you can respond to and react to. Now, when my wife and I were getting involved in Palestine solidarity work, quite often people would come to us and they'd say to us, you know, well, what we need to be doing is we need to be doing, say, for instance, what B'nai B'rith Canada is doing, or we need to be doing what this other pro-Israel organization is doing. And, you know, I'd sort of think about that and I think, but gosh, you know, we don't, you know, that organization just has all these financial resources that we don't have. You know, we can't plan as if we have all this money in the bank, or we can't plan as if we have this influence with the media or influence, you know, access to the corridors of power. So I sort of thought, like, gosh, it just seems to me that the environment that we're functioning in is very different than the environment in which these pro-Israel advocacy groups function in. And so I thought, gosh, well, maybe we should just sort of do a SWOT analysis of what where we are, and sort of compare that to what we might assume that a SWOT analysis of B'nai B'rith Canada would be. And I think the opportunities for them are much different than the opportunities for us. And our strengths are much different than their strengths, if you know what I mean. So finally, when Jeremy approached me, as I mentioned, for the book, we had done a SWOT analysis for CJPME, but I thought, gosh, you can do a SWOT analysis on an entire sector. It doesn't have to be focused on a specific business or a specific nonprofit. And so I thought that's what I thought could be useful in terms of presenting something at the symposium. And then following up with that with a chapter in this book and sort of look at some of these things. And quite often people, I find people in Palestine Solidarity Movement sort of bewail the fact that we don't have this and we don't have that and we don't have the money that we need and so on. But in fact, there are many things that we do have that many other movements don't have. And I think that's why it's useful and sometimes, you know, invigorating to actually go through this thought process and realize, you know, there are a lot of things working in our favor.
So it kind of started, the idea to create this chapter and have it based on this exercise called SWOT was in essence to help the Palestinian Solidarity Movement see what works for them and trailblaze their own path instead of following what the opposition might be doing.
Exactly. That we're just very different. Our environment, we'll get to it, our strengths and our opportunities are much different than what you'd have for B'nai B'rith Canada or the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, the two main pro-Israel advocacy organizations today. Mm-hmm.
So I guess we should start off with the first letter, which is S for strengths. What, in your estimation, are the strengths of the Palestinian movement here in Canada or in generally also?
Yeah, well, I will focus on Canada. Yeah, obviously, some of the things I'll mention about Canada do apply to the Palestine Solidarity Movement, you know, in other countries as well. But the focus is, to some degree, here, Canada. So I'll just run through a number of them. And if you have comments you want to make, please jump in. Don't hesitate. So first of all, one of the things that I think is one of our biggest strengths is that we have a large population of Canadians who've been personally touched by the Israel-Palestine conflict. And what I mean by this, obviously, there's Palestinian Canadians, right? Obviously, who are here in Canada, who have emigrated. My wife is one of those, but there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of other Palestinian Canadians. But beyond that, there are people that have then met these Palestinian Canadians, our spouses or their children. And you have obviously much of the rest of the population, immigrant population from the Levant, whether it's Syria or Lebanon or Jordan or Egypt to some degree, certainly Iraq and other areas. Those countries have likewise been impacted by the Israel-Palestine conflict, whether through the refugee situation, the Palestinian refugee situation, or just the way their government sort of dance around the issue and so on. So a lot of people have really been, their lives have been impacted. They might actually be immigrants to Canada because of the Palestine-Israel conflict. And they're not, their lives haven't just sort of been peripherally touched. Their lives have been dramatically changed, dramatically transformed or impacted by the Israel-Palestine conflict. And, you know, so I think sometimes people say, there's not enough people getting involved and so on. But I think, you know, if you compare our movement to sort of, I don't know, like an environmental movement for the polar bear or something like that, save the polar bear. Well, how many people actually, you know, encounter polar bears and how many people's lives have been impacted by a polar bear? Probably a much smaller number. So I think, you know, there are, you know, it's not something that's sort of theoretical. For many people in Canada, literally hundreds of thousands of people in Canada, this is something that's very real that has directly impacted their lives.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree with you that the human element is definitely a strength and I think would lead to a lot of empathy and compassion. And that kind of emotional connection can be very powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Another area that I'd say is a huge strength of us is the cause that we're fighting for is broadly supported by international law, both human rights and humanitarian law. So we don't have to sort of twist ourselves into pretzels to sort of try to win some sort of rhetorical debate, about sort of things. So international law supports the Palestinian cause, supports it in dozens, hundreds of different ways. And so all we have to do is we just have to sort of say the truth, talk about what happened in Palestine, and talk about what international law says. So we don't have to sort of make up some sort of structure, some sort of argumentative structure. The other side does. The other side, they have to play all these games, and it's just, I don't know how they sleep with themselves at night, sort of with all the sort of different spurious arguments that they put out there to sort of convince people that somehow what Israel is doing is justified and is legal.
The mental gymnastics are quite astounding, very impressive.
Absolutely are. And sometimes you just see what they're doing and it's just you laugh. So this is really a huge strength. And I think sometimes we take that for granted. Another, I think, strength of the Palestinian cause is that it resembles other historic causes. And obviously, we're seeing that even more. You know, I presented this in February 2019. But of course, you know, just in the last year, we've seen all sorts of human rights organizations who have literally come out and said that Israel is practicing apartheid against Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Of course, apartheid makes reference or sort of calls on the sort of historic example of apartheid, which is in South Africa. And so, in fact, that the Palestinian cause does resemble in some respects the anti-apartheid movement that blacks in South Africa waged against the apartheid regime in South Africa. There's other things, also civil rights movements. So we actually, in CJPME, we did a video series called Oppression 101, where we actually sort of drew these historical parallels between what the Palestinians are going through and what other historical groups have gone through. So it really is this sort of issue which resembles very much other historic causes. And we would do well to cite that, to bring that up. Mm-hmm. Another comment I make, it sort of resonates, it's sort of along the lines, same lines as my previous point. It resonates with this natural sense of justice. You know, you look at a picture of a Palestinian village next to an illegal Israeli settlement, and you see the large homes in the settlement and modern and built up and with good infrastructure and so on. And then you see the impoverished Palestinian town next to it, you know, which is prevented from accessing resources and to which access is difficult, and the roads are sort of falling apart and everything. And it's sort of, there's this natural sense of justice, I think, a natural sense of among human beings that, you know, you root for the underdog. And I think those of us who work in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement can very much sort of plug into that we are fighting for the underdog. And that's sort of a natural, people naturally sort of like that sort of a juxtaposition, I guess you could call it.
I really like, and it's very hopeful and optimistic that you say that the Palestinian Solidarity Movement resembles other historic causes and also has this natural sense of justice, because on the ground right now, it seems like such a monumental task. Mm-hmm. But it is comforting to know that history is on our side and that what we are doing is just, even though right now it's very difficult and even though we have so much work to do, but that work can't be done without those difficult conversations, and it can't be done without the existence of the Palestinian Solidarity Movement to begin with.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Palestinians are doing everything they can do on the ground, and the least we can do is at least sort of stand up for them and sort of announce their cause to the world. Mm-hmm. Where we are, you know, I can't participate in a demonstration in Jerusalem, but I can stand up and, you know, in Canada, and can try to meet with members of parliament, can try to meet mm-hmm. with, you know, local governments and so on. So yeah, absolutely. And the final thing I might mention, strengths, to wrap up here our discussion on strengths, is just another thing that we take for granted is that broad support that we have at the United Nations and just sort of generally internationally. You know, there are literally dozens and dozens of resolutions that have been passed over the decades, which, you know, incontrovertibly, you know, support the Palestinian cause, not because people love Palestinians per se, but because the Palestinian cause is just so just. So you have, as I say, literally dozens of resolutions condemning Israel on all range of human rights violations that Israel commits on a regular basis. And many of our listeners may be aware, we've put a certain focus on 16 resolutions that come up, that are brought up every fall by Palestine's allies at the United Nations, where we say, you know, the 16 resolutions all calling attention to the fact that Israel is violating the human rights of Palestinians, and the UN votes in support of those resolutions every single year. Those, and of course, dozens of others that have been passed over the years. So this is very significant that there's just huge international support for the Palestinian cause.
I'd love to talk about the strengths of the Palestinian Solidarity Movement for this entire podcast, but we should probably move on to that second letter. What are some of the weaknesses that you see in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in Canada as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are strengths, but there are also weaknesses. So I'll mention a few things here. One of them is that to some degree our constituency is often divided within itself, and it's a very natural sort of thing. We don't need to beat ourselves up about it, but you do have different things, you know. For example, you have Palestinian refugees that there's a huge Palestinian refugee population in Lebanon. Now that has had an impact on Lebanon. And that has had an impact on perceptions of the Lebanese of the Palestinian cause. So sometimes you might have a situation where, you know, Lebanese are not necessarily partial to the Palestinian cause because of the impact of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and resentment towards the presence of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. You also have, you know, Palestinians and Arabs in general. There are a lot of things that sort of naturally can be division points among Arabs and within the Palestinian community. Of course, within the Palestinian Canadian community, sometimes you can have people that aren't struggle to work together because some are sort of more supportive of Hamas, or some are more supportive of Fatah or things, or some are resentful of the Palestinian Authority and what it has done over the past 25 years. So these things happen. So it's not a sort of monolith by any means, and there are sort of fractures within the movement that sometimes prevent people from working together easily. On the other hand, I think these are sort of eclipsed by the many things that unite people that are from the Middle East and unite people that sort of are interested in these issues. Another aspect is, of course, the fact that here in Canada, many of the people who make up sort of our natural constituency, or what I sort of consider our natural constituency, are first and second generation Canadians who are still struggling to establish themselves both civically and economically. So they may not be in a position to, you know, have a lot of money to be able to donate to organizations that do Palestine solidarity work. These communities are not necessarily present in the corridors of power and influence. You know, I'm very excited when I see like people like Nahla Ayad, who's a Palestinian Canadian who is who's really reaching the top echelons of the CBC. But she's one of the first. But yeah, I'm excited when I see members of immigrant communities, you know, ascending the media hierarchy, or men, you know, ascending into parliament or into positions of authority in government. But it takes time, right? It's not easy for a first or second generation Canadian to ascend and enter into these corridors of power. But it will come. But we're still at that stage where much of our constituency are relatively new immigrants. And as well, they're not fully mobilized politically. A story that I often tell about my wife is my wife emigrated to Canada in 1983 from Lebanon. My wife is a Palestinian refugee from Lebanon. And she, her father, when she left Lebanon to come here, he said, "Whatever you do, don't get involved in religion or politics." And so that's quite often the mentality, right, is that, you know, just get a job, just establish yourself financially. And that is still sort of the you know, the emphasis. It's natural, right? You're an immigrant. You're trying to put down roots, and it's not easy. Well, you know, I'm gonna put aside putting down roots. I'm not gonna worry about, you know, my economic future. I'm just gonna sort of be an activist. Well, that it's to make that decision as an individual is not easy.
Yeah, it's definitely a privilege being able to do activism work. You need to, it's not very lucrative. So, you know, you need to be able to support yourself and your family before being able to take on a politically motivated ventures, which is completely fair.
Exactly. And it will come. I mean, one of the things that I often mention is that, I think over time, currently, I think sort of activism is not necessarily something that's valorized in immigrant communities. Parents want their kids to be lawyers and doctors and engineers and stuff. And if I were an immigrant parent, I would want that too. But over time, these other careers paths will be valorized as the communities become more established. I think another aspect of that is also sort of developing the ability to articulate the issues to a Western audience. I think many people that come from the Middle East, there's a different way of thinking, a different way of making arguments, a different way of proving your point from the Middle East and North America. I won't go too much into that. I have a lot to say on that point. But I think quite often people of Middle East origin, it does take them a little bit of time to sort of understand how do I present this issue to my Western friends, my English or French friends here in Canada. Another challenge that we have in the Palestine Solidarity Movement is the absence of longstanding experienced institutions to speak for the cause. You know, if you look at the Jewish Canadian community here in Canada, they've worked very hard to create institutions which serve them, which have institutional knowledge, which are well funded, and that will come for other communities. But we have to work for that. We have to invest in that. But it's something that we need to, I think, work towards. And actually, that's one of my people that know me well know that one of my concerns long term is that indeed we establish institutions that can serve the Palestinian cause, longstanding, well-funded institutions that can serve the Palestinian cause. And so I guess there are other things that I could mention, but why don't we call it quits there with respect to the weaknesses? I think we've covered some of the main ones.
Sure. So the next letter is O for opportunities. What are some of the opportunities that you've been able to identify that Palestinian solidarity movements in Canada should look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is where it really gets exciting because there are a lot of opportunities. One of the things I often point out is that I say we have an opponent which totally overreacts and overplays its hand again and again and again. Mm-hmm. You know, I think part of the reason that the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, you know, emerged just so explosively is because the other side just so overreacted to it. You know, there's motions, and I don't think, you know, how many Canadians have heard of the BDS movement until the other side sort of insisted that Parliament pass a motion condemning the BDS movement? Well, that was maybe the best thing that ever happened for the BDS movement in Canada, because it actually put the BDS movement into center stage.
Yeah, they almost told on themselves.
Yeah, it's crazy. And they do that again and again in various ways. And I think to another aspect of that is I think a lot of people feel bullied by the pro-Israel mm-hmm. community. You know, we see this with the IRA definition. The IRA definition is a threat in certain ways and so on as well. But it's also, you know, people don't like to be bullied. So if you're a university administrator or a district school board administrator, or you know, there are all these various different forums where the pro-Israel groups are just trying to force their way and impose their mindset and control the discourse. And I think people really, really respond very negatively to that over time. I said, were you going to say something?
No, I agree. And we see it all the time online, especially online, because it's so easy. You know, people are hidden behind their computers and there's a degree of anonymity and people are more, it's just easier to type something out and tweet it and it's out there forever. And then people jump on and it just becomes this landslide and it can be very overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah. So really, to some degree, because they so overreact and overplay their hand, mm-hmm. it's actually an opportunity for us.
Yeah.
The other thing, that the next huge point is, there's a huge population of undecided Canadians that we can easily educate. You know, there are so many people when I meet them, they just, you know, for me, for example, and I think I speak for many people, when I went through high school and university, I never, ever had anyone sort of explain the history of Palestine and Israel to me. You know, I had to pick it up as an adult. I remember once when I was in graduate school, there was a guy that he was on my dormitory floor and he had a flag on his door and I didn't recognize the flag. And I saw the guy and said, "Oh, by the way, what's that flag on your door?" And he said, it's a Palestinian flag. And I said, "Well, where's Palestine?" And he just like blew up. He went ballistic. But for me, it's like, well, where's Palestine? I've never seen it on a map, you know. So there is, you know, I think a lot of Canadians that they just really haven't had the luxury of someone sort of sitting them down and explaining things to them. So I think there are a lot of undecided Canadians that if we just had the opportunity to explain a little bit of the history, sort of show them the maps, explain what happened in 1947, 1948, they, you know, our side, it's people will naturally come to our side because it's the just side. You know, Palestinians, yeah, just like indigenous people here, they have a right to sort of live their lives, have their land, and, you know, have their own country, you know. So mm-hmm. yes, we just need, you know, given the time, we can win them over. So it's mm-hmm. not like people are predisposed against us. We just have to tell them our truth.
Yeah, in fact, one of the surveys that we did on Canadians' attitudes, I mean, these are average Canadians who probably don't know that much and don't know the details of the Palestinian cause and don't know the history. But when you give them a question and state that, you know, Israel is committing human rights abuses and it is against international law, should Canada be sanctioning because of these actions? And once that is kind of set out in the open, people tend to lean very favorably to imposing sanctions, because you're correct, it is the just thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's great that you brought up the point of these public opinion surveys. We've done, I guess, two public opinion surveys dedicated to this sort of question of Israel-Palestine. And yeah, consistently sort of the undecided sort of default to the just cause, the just, you know, so absolutely, it's good that you brought that up. There's several other things. I'll mention them briefly. I won't go too much into detail. I've been very excited in recent years that there's so much cooperation and mutual support among Palestinian solidarity actors. I think the degree of communication is excellent. There's a number of different things. So there's a number of really encouraging things in terms of, I think, people working together. Sometimes, you know, in any social movement, sometimes you can have sort of turf wars and things like that. And it's not unique to Palestine Solidarity, I think everything. But I've been involved in Palestine Solidarity work for 20 years. And I think some of the best collaboration that I've seen has been just in the past 2 or 3 years. So just some excellent work going on and really a lot of selfless leaders in the Palestine Solidarity movement. Another exciting thing, of course, is the sort of the rise of the intersectional view. Now, I know in academic circles, intersectionalism was being discussed back in the 1990s. I only heard the term intersectionalism about 6 or 7 years ago. And of course, there's sort of the academic definition of intersectionalism. And then there's sort of the sort of let's sort of work together. We have common cause type of intersectionalism understanding. Mm-hmm. And I think that second part is more what I'm referring to, is just sort of people realizing that there are various structures of oppression that many different movements are facing, whether it be Black Lives Matter or Idle No More or Palestinian Solidarity. And I think people are in these different movements are realizing it. We're seeing Black activists standing up for the Palestinian cause and Palestinians getting interested in indigenous issues and so on and so forth. And that is super exciting.
For sure. I mean, even last year after, Canada's has started this discussion not only on our colonial history with Indigenous peoples, but also how that colonial history on a global scale has affected Black communities and Black people. And when Israel was bombing Gaza in 2021, all of these movements were expressing support for and solidarity with Palestinians. And I think that's such a great example of how this intersection of colonialism has affected so many people in so many communities. And I definitely agree, it's a great opportunity and there's definitely strength in numbers.
Yeah. Well, and something, I guess the thing that really strikes me is that you didn't have this 20 years ago. I didn't feel this 20 years ago. So no, Madeline, you're much younger than me. And to some degree, you've almost sort of, you know, started your career with this sort of part of the environment. But for me, these are new. These are new developments. So it's exciting for me to see them. And your examples are just fantastic. It's very much like, as you say, but it wasn't always like that. Just one or two other quick things. I think another opportunity for us is that we do have very much legal mechanisms and protections to pursue our cause sort of here in Canada. You know, I'm not too concerned. You know, there's all this sort of people are sort of making a big issue of the BDS movement. You know, I know there are certain things going on in the States right now, and there was a recent legal decision by a court. But, you know, boycotting is a democratic right. It's a freedom of expression thing. We are protected. We, in terms of advocating for our cause, we have the legal mechanisms and the sort of legal channels to pursue our cause. We just have to keep at it, and we just have to, we can't be silent. So there's a lot that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there. In fact, for instance, a great example of that would be just a day or two ago, The Palestinian Canadian Congress and the Legal Center for Palestine actually launched a lawsuit, they launched a complaint to the Ontario Human Rights Commission regarding the Ford government's, the Ontario Ford government's discrimination against Palestinian students in various school boards. And that's a perfect example of exercising the legal mechanisms that we have available to us. We just have to sort of grow into that. You know, I was talking about, you know, some of the weaknesses. So we're growing into that. You know, the Legal Center for Palestine is a new development. It's a new organization recently established. And so it's going to be able to make use of that legal mechanism. So these are, you know, other exciting opportunities.
So finally, T is for threats. Yep. What are some of the threats that you see to the Palestinian solidarity movement in the years ahead?
Sure. Well, one thing I think probably a lot of people would probably easily agree with my strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities. Threats, people might disagree a little bit with some of these things. Of course, all this is Tom Woodley's personal opinion. So please, if you disagree with me, don't take it personally. And yeah, you know, I'm happy to discuss these things with you, but especially with threats, these are some personal observations that I have. Not everyone may agree, but I think it's worth thinking about some of these things. Of course, I think one threat that everyone will agree with is the increased weaponization of anti-Semitism. I mentioned Ira earlier. I said it, you know, it's an example of the other side overplaying their hand and bullying people, but it also is. It is a threat to some of our work, and I think it's right. I think CJPME, especially IJV, has been working very hard to combat the IRA definition and the weaponization of anti-Semitism. We're certainly thankful for their work. But, of course, you know, they are trying to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. I think it's a battle that they'll lose over time, but there might be it's a war that they'll lose over time, but there might be battles here and there that they win, and it might make it a little bit difficult for us from time to time in sort of advancing our cause. That's definitely a threat. There's a crowded landscape of human rights and humanitarian issues. You know, I think, again, I'm coming up with examples that here in 2022, and even though I said this, you know, this was my thesis back in 2019, but, you know, look at the war in Ukraine, right? That's taking up so much bandwidth in terms of people's concerns and human rights and Russian aggression. And of course, you have the conflict in Yemen, which, you know, and the, both human rights and humanitarian issues. And there's sometimes a danger, right? That there can be sort of issue fatigue or sort of humanitarian fatigue, that there are just so many needs in the world. And can people continue to be focused on Palestinian human rights and Palestinian humanitarian needs when, you know, year after year after year, when there are other sort of new and very urgent issues? And I remember a few years ago, I remember someone, a Palestinian, actually saying that, like, they can understand why people might be more partial or more sympathetic to what's going on in Yemen, because at that point in time, things were, you know, it was crisis level in Yemen. And yet, you know, we still need UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, still needs funding, still needs help. So, but it's difficult. You know, you have this crowded landscape, as I say.
Yeah.
Another challenge is the normalization of Israeli abuses and facts on the ground. You know, Israel, year after year, is, you know, building colonies, building settlements, evicting Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, that stuff is changing stuff on the ground. It's difficult to reverse that. You know, you look at something like Canada and you say, well, how can you reverse the dispossession of the indigenous people in Canada? And it's like, you know, so if you sort of think of that, and it's going on in Israel, that every year, every decade that passes as Israel colonizes and dispossesses the Palestinians, it's harder and harder to reverse some of those things on the ground. Another point I'll mention is, now, here, some people may disagree with me, but hear me out, hopefully. I, what I call overreaction, on campuses and in different sort of spheres of discourse, you know, the pro-Israel groups have a long time sort of wanted to sort of shutter or what's the word, muzzle Palestinian people speaking on Palestinian human rights. So, you know, we've had many events in the past where, whether it's Norm Finkelstein or someone else that we've invited to speak, pro-Israel groups will sort of do what they can to try to prevent our speaker from our event from taking place. You know, that's their card to play. They've never won against us, but that's their card to play. But I think it's dangerous when our side, when the progressives do that and try to shut things up. And the reason I say that, it sort of ties in with some of our strengths. The reason I say that is that our cause depends very much on a free discourse. The other side, their cause depends on people not discussing things. Our cause depends on people discussing things, an open discourse, ability to discuss anything. You know, I often say that the other side, the pro-Israel groups, they never want to debate them. IJV and CJPME, we've challenged the pro-Israel groups to an open debate. They don't want to debate because they know they'll lose. Yeah. And so we have to keep that in mind that, you know, our side depends much more. I talked about, you know, all these Canadians that are undecided, they just need to learn more. Well, if there's no forum for discussion, then these undecided Canadians will never hear our side. So we have to be careful that we don't overreact. Yeah, go ahead. You're going to say.
Well, you mentioned Norm Finkelstein, and I was just about to bring him up because I saw a video online, and I forget exactly what was being said, but he was giving a lecture at, I think, Western, I'm pretty sure it was, in Ontario. And, you know, people are asking questions, and someone came up and was very accusatory, calling him an anti-Semite, saying that they couldn't believe that he would go up on stage and say such horrible things about Israel. And he broke down what that person was saying and dismantled it so beautifully. And I think that that's so important. We need that open discourse. And like I said earlier, that discourse is going to be extremely uncomfortable. But, you know, that's the only way that things change. We need to learn as a society, and we need to change. And that's not going to happen if we don't talk about it.
Right. And the final threat I'll talk about is I call it sort of, I summarize in bickering, that we need to be careful that we don't adopt a tone that resembles too much the other side. You know, we need to be the reasonable ones. We can't, you know, well, there was once a guy from the Bloc Québécois. He said to me, you know, Tom, les Québécois, ils n'aiment pas la chicane. Quebecers don't like just mindless arguing. Mm-hmm. And so if people perceive us, if people perceive the pro-Israel people, they're just arguing and shouting louder and we're just shouting back. If people just perceive this to be a shouting match and that there's sort of both sides are sort of equally wrong or equally right, then that's to our disadvantage. We need to demonstrate that our tone is different, that our tone is more mature, that our tone is factually based, legally based. And it's not because we're shouting louder that we're right. It's because we have the facts and the law on our side and justice on our side. So we need to be careful to avoid this sort of, to avoid coming across as bickering with the other side. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, I could go on, but let's stop there with the threat. So hopefully that's a useful discussion.
We don't want to get too down talking about the threats. That's it. Is there anything that you wanted to add that falls outside of the SWAT exercise framework before we wrap up?
Yeah. There, you know, one of the things that I realized in doing this is that two or three things I'll mention. But first thing, there are things that are out of our control, right? So I've mentioned, well, yeah, CJPME puts a lot of focus on human rights, and that's sort of our angle in terms of Palestine solidarity work. But there's certain things that are just out of our control, and that, you know, Palestinians aren't perfect, and the Palestinian leadership isn't perfect, and you know, there are Palestinian leaders that say unwise things, and Palestinian political parties that say and do unwise things, and actors on the Palestinian side that, well, we can't control that, so we have to sort of focus on what we can control, I guess, or what truly is what we're fighting for. So quite often I say to our staff, I say, look, let's never put ourselves in a position of sort of defending a particular Palestinian leader or defending a particular Palestinian political party. We're doing this because of Palestinian human rights. So where we should be putting ourselves is in a position of defending Palestinian human rights and Palestinian justice. So, but there are things that are out of our control, and sometimes these things work in our favor and sometimes they work against us. I remember back in the 2000s when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was the leader of Iran, or I guess the president of Iran, and he would just say ridiculous things, and the other side would sort of amplify that, and he'd say very anti-Semitic things, and he'd sort of become the world's poster child for the Palestinian movement. Well, that was the worst possible thing for us, because he was, at some level, he was to some degree anti-Semitic. And he said things that would sound very inflammatory, very threatening. And the other side just had a field day with the types of things. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, he's out of the picture now. But, you know, you can't control that, you know, that sort of thing. So you just have to sort of accept that there are certain things out of your control. The mm-hmm. poor caliber of leadership in other countries in the Middle East. I wish that you had, you know, principled leaders in those other countries who would stand up for the Palestinian cause because it's the right thing to do and because they actually believe in that cause, but they don't. So these are certain things that we can't beat ourselves up. We can't sort of give up because other people aren't doing the things that we think they should do, or other people are doing things that aren't necessarily productive or effective.
Right.
And one final thing I say, and I probably meant to say this at the beginning, is this SWAT exercise, or this sort of these what do you call it, these observations that I've made about the Palestine Solidarity Movement as a whole, you know, there's all different ways to do Palestine solidarity work. CJPME, we tend to have a focus on the human rights side of things, but there's so many different ways to be a Palestine solidarity activist. You know, if you're talking about Palestinian culture, that's very much, you know, Palestine solidarity work. You know, if you're just sharing your life story, sharing Palestinian narrative, that's very much so culture, sharing your experiences. Even, you know, of course, I'm not originally Palestinian myself, but there are people that, you know, are involved in Palestinian solidarity work for Palestinian nationalism, that they are there to sort of support a Palestinian state. And I understand that. It makes perfect sense if I were Palestinian. And so that's another very valid reason to sort of be fighting in the Palestinian solidarity cause. So there are all different reasons to do this, that you don't have to do this just for human rights. That's CJPME's mm-hmm. focus. But you can. There's also very valid reasons to, you know, to support Palestinian nationalism, to want the Palestinians to have their own state. And there are good justifications for that. And so there are many different ways. So the lens that I've put on this sort of discussion in terms of S, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, tends to sort of focus on the human rights side of things.
Right.
But there may be a different. So in as much as I said, you know, saying that we should do what the pro-Israel organizations are doing, well, not every Palestinian solidarity organization needs to do what CJPME is doing. So just as, you know, we don't want to put one lens on CJPME's work, we don't want to put CJPME's lens on somebody else's work. So I think it would, you know, anyone can do this sort of SWAT exercise in terms of their sphere of operation, and it can be useful. So I certainly don't want to presume that sort of our experiences in CJPME and our experiences in Palestine Solidarity, extrapolate to everybody else. So right. I just wanted to mention that.
Great. Did you want to do the podcast wrap up, or would you like me to do it?
Well, I think you've done a great job. I think these have been great questions here and great great things. I've had fun. I'm sorry to make you listen to me so long. So people, I think, have heard enough of me on this podcast. So why don't you do the wrap up, and you'll probably do it much more. People get your sing-song voice and be done with me. How is that?
Sure. So thank you to everyone for listening today. I hope everyone has enjoyed our podcast. When Michael is back from vacation, we'll look forward to hearing from him about his chapter from this exciting new book, Advocating for Palestine in Canada. If you're interested in getting a copy, we've put a link to the book at Fernwood Publishing in the show notes. If you're a listener and you've enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find our program and learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any comments, suggestions, or questions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who helped to make this podcast and all CJPME's other activities possible. So that's it for now. We look forward to having you all with us for our next podcast. Take care, and see you all again soon.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
We'll be right back.